There's nothing like watching something that's still and then all of a sudden seeing the first ice chunk move, and then all of a sudden you've got, you know, the ice jam moving, and you maybe drive downstream and watch it at different moments and watch kind of that pulse of ice coming through. So I feel like that's been really fun the last few years, watching that happen on the Klondike.
This is Yukon North of Ordinary. I'm Karen McCall. There's a phenomenon in the Yukon known as breakup. It's not about relationships, but if that subject interests you, check out my other podcast, Frisky North of 60. Today, though, breakup refers to when the ice on rivers breaks and the water starts flowing again. It's a big deal in some communities, a highly anticipated event marking the end of winter and the beginning of spring. In West Dawson, for example, breakup means people will soon be able to cross the Yukon River by ferry to get into Dawson City after being cut off for potentially weeks. In other communities, breakup can bring a threat of serious flooding. Holly Goulding is a senior hydrologist with the government of Yukon. I'm speaking to her today about all things river breakup. And just a note, this interview is not a forecast for the upcoming breakup season. It's more like River Breakup 101. When we talk about river breakup, what do we mean exactly?
Yeah, so in the Yukon, ice covers most rivers and lakes over the wintertime. And so breakup refers to the period in the spring when that ice cover deteriorates and it breaks into pieces. It's a time of year when there's a lot of change happening. It's a really anticipated time in northern communities because it's sort of the end of winter. It's also a period of time where people are stuck, maybe where they are. They're not able to travel across the river. So it means a lot of things. And scientifically, it's sort of the act of that river ice moving out, but it also, I think, represents the beginning of spring.
And as a senior water, or as a hydrologist, what is your role with tracking this?
Yeah, so my position as senior hydrologist involves leading the Governor of Yukon's flood forecasting efforts. So in the Yukon, flooding primarily occurs as a result of river ice breakup or snowmelt peak flows. And there are some basins where we also have glacier contributions to flooding. So I work with a team of folks from across government and other governments, and we carry out monitoring of snow, water, ice, and weather. And using that data that's collected, I track conditions closely and will follow breakup as it is heading towards critical communities and communicate to emergency response officials when there might be conditions that result in elevated flood risk.
What are the main rivers that you're keeping an eye on?
Yeah, so in the Yukon, historically, the worst breakups that have resulted in flooding in communities have been on the Yukon and Klondike rivers around the community of Dawson and Rock Creek, and the Porcupine River that impacts Old Crow. And so Old Crow is in northern Yukon. It's a fly-in community, and it's completely in the floodplain. Dawson is at the confluence of the Yukon and the Klondike rivers, so it's impacted by the breakup of both rivers, with the Yukon being more of a driver for some of the worst events that happen in Dawson City. And then the Klondike River impacts also communities up the Klondike Valley, just outside of Dawson City.
Pre-breakup, during the winter, obviously we have a long winter in the Yukon. What is going on with these rivers? Is the ice sort of accumulating to a certain point? And is there still moving water underneath this ice?
Yeah, so the river ice season in the Yukon starts in the fall and early winter. So that's in October and November. We have air temperatures that are starting to drop, and we have precipitation that starts falling as snow. And so we have the flow in the river starting to decrease, and we have ice covers starting to form on the rivers. For most big rivers, the flow will continue through the winter. We'll have flow through those rivers, and that's because of the contribution of groundwater that's continuing to flow through the rivers. We call that the base flow. And that ice cover forms in the fall or early winter, and it can form smoothly, but it can also, if there's a period of warming after it forms, it can get jumbled up. And we would call that a more of a dynamic freeze up. And so that can result in a bit of a thicker ice cover. Combined with that, even with a smoother ice cover through the winter, if we have a really cold winter, we'll see ice accumulating or thickening more. So we tend to think of a colder winter as being one where we'll end up having a thicker ice cover, generally speaking. And those are some of the conditions that, you know, contribute to what will breakup be like in the spring.
So that the conditions that lead to breakup start as soon as freeze up starts to happen.
Yeah. And I mean, even before, depending on what the flows are leading into freeze up. And then on the flow side, heading into the springtime, we've got that flow dropping and dropping. And so usually we see our minimum flows in the Yukon just prior to breakup, sort of in mid to late March. And then it's when that warming starts to happen and we see flows increasing in the rivers. That's when the breakup period starts. So we do see the low flow kind of just before that period.
So flows start increasing. Is that because the temperature is rising and the snowpack is starting to melt?
Yeah. So when temperatures start being above zero, but even beforehand, with a lot of the solar ration we have here, we have these really long days already starting in early spring. That contributes to melting of the snowpack. And then so we start seeing, you know, flows coming into smaller creeks and into, you know, larger streams and rivers. And so, yeah, that's kind of the process of the beginning of the spring melt. And that spring snowmelt period we call the freshet period. And that's right from the sort of the beginning of the melt of snow and then the rivers starting to rise until we see some peak flows. In Yukon, that's typically later into June, late May, June, and sometimes even early July for some of the bigger systems and the systems that have lakes in them.
What are you able to monitor remotely over the winter season? Are you able to know how much water is flowing into the main rivers, the Yukon and the Porcupine River?
Yeah, so, you know, in partnership with Environment and Climate Change Canada, we fund hydrometric stations across the Yukon. So these are stations that monitor river flows and levels and lake levels across the territory. And, you know, folks that paddle or folks that spend time on the land will be familiar with these data. They're available in near real time, so they transmit kind of continuously. And that those are critical. And part of the reason that we fund those stations is that they're critical to our forecasting efforts. So there's some key stations upstream of, for example, Dawson and Old Crow, and also in a variety of other communities to assist our forecasting efforts for both breakup and snowmelt flooding. So those data are really important, and we track those through the winter so we can see, looking at water levels and flows, those decreases, what systems are higher than normal, what systems are lower than normal, and that can give us an idea of how the flow is progressing through the winter. For example, right now we know in many systems we have higher than average flows. The other thing that we have at some of these stations kind of closer to the springtime that's important for us is we do have real-time cameras at some of them. And so it gives us a sense of what the ice is doing. And we're gradually increasing the coverage of those cameras so we have a better idea of what are some of the ice conditions leading into breakup. In terms of understanding what the river thickness might be, you know, we're tracking conditions in the fall to understand how freeze-up happened. But then through the winter, our best guess at how the ice is evolving is actually watching temperatures. So, and knowing how cold a winter has been compared to usual gives us an idea of whether we can expect the ice to be thicker, average, or thinner than we would typically see in the system.
Let's talk about the actual breakup processes. What are some of the ways a river might break up?
Yeah, so breakup occurs when upstream forces, and that's kind of the influence of those flows that are starting to increase, exceed the downstream forces that are resisting or holding the ice cover in place. So you can imagine this kind of push-pull of the flow coming from the upstream and the ice holding tight downstream. And so, you know, breakup will be happening in different ways across different reaches from the headwaters of a river all the way to the mouth. And so in northward flowing rivers, for example, we have this phenomenon where you've got quite a bit more warming in the south. So you might have snowmelt happening, you've got, you know, low elevation snowpacks being depleted, and you've got that flow moving northward, where in the more northern reaches, you actually have cooler conditions and maybe cloudier conditions. And so the ice is actually still very resistant. And so in some rivers, you kind of have this really predominant or pronounced wave of breakup that is working its way from upstream to downstream. And that's very evident on the Mackenzie River in the Northwest Territories. Less so in the Yukon and the Porcupine, but they are still rivers that have that kind of northward gradient. And so that's why we have breakups that can be more severe. And so we have two types of breakup, and I better just stop and maybe explain that because it gives some context here. We have what we call mechanical or dynamic breakups. And that's the scenario I'm talking about where you have this flow pushing from the headwaters, or in the case of these rivers, the south, towards a more resistant ice cover in the north. And so that flow can be stronger than the resistance of the ice. It can break it up, but then the ice is actually still these quite big and very strong blocks of ice. And so they're more likely to jam. And it's ice jams actually that are the big concern for flooding.
What is an ice jam?
Yeah, so an ice jam is when broken up ice will jam up against something downstream. So that could be a solid ice cover. It could be a constriction in the channel. It could be a variety of kind of river morphological features. But you've got sort of this broken ice that now is stalled out against a downstream object or ice cover. And so that jammed up ice can cause a lot of additional friction, and it holds back the water like a dam would. And so we have a lot of water that stacks up behind that. And that water we call the backwater effect. And so that's really what is a big concern in terms of raising water levels. And so in terms of an ice jam, we have the toe of the jam. That's what's stuck against an object. And then we have the head of the jam, the upstream side of a jam. And an ice jam might grow or shrink depending on a couple factors. So, you know, if it's been in place for a while, we've got kind of that warming influence of, you know, the sun, the warming in the air, and also the water. And so the jam might gradually sort of shrink. You know, a lot of the sort of roughness at the bottom of the jam will smooth away. But then if you have more ice coming from upstream and stacking up against the head of the jam, it'll grow bigger, hold back more water, and so on and so forth. And so when we're looking at ice jams relative to a community, there's a couple kind of concerning locations. If the jam forms just downstream of a community and kind of the head of the jam might be within or above upstream of the community, then we really can see really drastic water level increases quite suddenly. And, you know, the highest water levels tend to be kind of in the middle section of the ice jam. If the ice jam forms downstream of town, it can still back up water all the way into town. Last year and in 91, there was an ice jam that formed at the Bluefish River, which is 42 kilometers downstream of Old Crow. And that jam got to be 35 kilometers long. And it flooded the town of Old Crow. Last year, it didn't flood the town. There was water levels that were starting to become concerning. But yeah, so the jams can get very long if ice is continuing to accumulate from what's coming from upstream, and they can cause water levels, you know, tens or more kilometers upstream to be quite elevated. There's also a circumstance where the ice jam might be upstream of town. And so now you've got sort of this dam that's sitting upstream of town that's going to break at any time. And so the concern there is when that ice jam breaks, there'll be a big wave of water coming down. And that's actually called a jave. It's a jam wave. And so you've got the jave moving downstream, and that can really cause very high water levels as it passes through. Of course, it's maybe less of a concern than a jam that's sitting in place downstream of a community, but it can really cause some impacts as well as that water moves its way downstream. But back to breakup. So what we can have is we have, you know, the snow on the ice starting to melt. We have sections that might be starting to deteriorate. There are some areas that might be more likely to deteriorate more quickly than others. And eventually we start having areas of open water. We might have ice starting to break and move, and it'll be pushing against more solid ice covers downstream. And so just to give you an example, on the Yukon River, unlike the Mackenzie that has this northward, southward direction, we actually have breakup that tends to start around the White River. So that's about 120 kilometers south of Dawson. And between the White River and the Stewart River, we have that starting. And that kind of pushes its way towards Dawson and onward down towards Eagle and into Alaska. And then meanwhile, Carmax breaks up more thermally. And so what that means is that there isn't that element of the push of flows from upstream, because we have water coming out of Lake LaBarge. You know, we have more of a storage element. And so that ice tends to melt more in place. And that's more of a thermal breakup. And because of that, that area tends to break up later. The ice comes off the river later because we have more of ice rotting in place and moving out, as opposed to this push of a stronger ice cover downstream with more of a capacity to jam up and cause high water levels.
So the thermal breakup is the preferred breakup.
Exactly. Thermal breakup, I mean, preferred to who? I mean, in a community, you might want to have breakup happen quickly and be over with so that the river's open and you can cross. But certainly from a flooding perspective, it's the thermal breakups that are less of a concern for ice jams that could cause some really serious flooding impacts in communities.
I read that thermal breakups are sometimes called mushouts, which kind of is a good visual for what you can kind of imagine what's
happening.
Yeah,
for sure. That's a great visual. And that's the kind of breakup you tend to see on lakes, if we can call it breakup at all. But that's how the ice tends to go out, because there isn't that push of the upstream flow.
Time for a short break. We'll be right back. Do you have a Yukon North of Ordinary hoodie yet? What about a t-shirt? a toque, mug. Check out the full product line at the retail store in Whitehorse, located on the corner of 2nd Avenue and Steel Street across from City Hall. Limited products can also be ordered from northofordinary.com. And while you're there, don't forget to pick up a magazine subscription. And now, back to the episode. Okay, so in breakup season, what are you doing? Obviously, you're kind of monitoring things from afar, but at a certain point, you're actually like out doing some like flyovers of some of the rivers. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, so I mentioned the data that we're watching. We're watching that those data really closely leading into breakup. We're watching water levels. Before we even go into communities, we have partners in communities and we're, you know, asking them for daily observations. We're getting photos. We're getting photos from those hydrometric stations I mentioned where we have cameras. So we're really trying to get a sense of what's happening on the ground. At some point, though, we need to understand the bigger picture of the rivers. So we actually rely on satellite images. We will use Sentinel-2, which is a visual image satellite, so we can actually see on the ground what the ice cover looks like. But it's not always clear skies during breakup. So we also rely on radar imagery. And so there are radar satellites that we have, and we're able to request imagery for the days that we need. And that works by sending a signal down to the ground. And based on how scattered the signal that comes back up is, we can use that to classify what's going on with the ice. So you either would have a solid ice cover, a deteriorated or kind of rotting ice cover. You might have an ice jam, which would be like a big jumble. And so we could actually see that through the classifications. Or we might have open water, which is smooth again. So we really rely on that imagery in the week to days leading up to breakup to better understand across, you know, hundreds of river kilometers, what's going on and where we might have concerns and how breakup's progressing. And then once we get closer, the satellite imagery, it just isn't often enough. It isn't giving us the resolution that we need to really understand what's going on in the river. So we'll head to community of Dawson first, usually in late April or early May, and we'll fly the river. And so, yeah, that involves being in a little Cessna, and we'll be, in the case of Dawson, we'll be starting from the White River, flying the river and flying beyond Dawson as well to understand what the ice cover looks like. And again, we'll be, you know, taking pictures and documenting what's happening in the river, where we have open ice, deteriorated ice, where we have ice jams that might be, you know, holding fast, but a concern for when they release. We're looking at conditions both upstream and downstream because we want to know the ice that's coming. And we also downstream, we want to know kind of how solid or strong the ice is that would be kind of holding back any ice coming from upstream. So we want to know where there might be ice jams and where those ice jams also might be forming.
When it's sort of peak breakup and if there is a potential for flooding or ice jamming, damming, are you sometimes like working almost around the clock to keep track of things?
Yeah, I mean, when flood risk is really high, we are checking conditions constantly. We might fly several times a day. You know, we have really long daylight hours, so we have a lot of flexibility for when we do fly if we have a concern. So yeah, and I've definitely checked water levels in the middle of the night just to see how things are progressing and to really understand if any changes have happened.
I want to go back for a second. You mentioned sort of before you get to the community, when you're managing things a bit more remotely and talking to people on the ground, what about sort of traditional knowledge and the role of like elders, people who've been watching these processes for a long time?
Yeah, we certainly understand that people that spend time on the land and elders in these communities, they really understand these processes. And there's things that we definitely learn every year from them. A couple of years ago, the open lead in front of Moosehide, so that means there used to be like open water that would sort of, but there usually is an open lead and an area of open water in front of Moosehide. And 2 years ago, that did not form. And, you know, we heard from elders like that was the first time that they had not seen that form. And so that, you know, for us meant it gave us this idea, this understanding of the fact that, you know, this is different and there's a greater potential for breakup because we don't have that kind of buffer that open water that typically stayed all winter in that area provided. And we did actually have, an ice jam that jammed in that location and did cause quite high water levels in Dawson, I think in the top five in terms of water levels in terms of the last kind of 40-ish years. So it was pretty significant.
I heard another hydrologist saying that one of the ways you can tell a breakup might be imminent is when the elders go down to the river to start watching it.
In Dawson, the elders say, oh, when the snow comes off of this particular face, then they know to start watching and sitting by the river. Similarly, in Old Crow, you know, that as breakup gets closer, there's more and more folks sitting by the river. So when I'm not flying, a lot of time I'm kind of by the river. If I'm not watching conditions that are coming in remotely, I'm by the river. I'm chatting with folks and understanding, you know, what it is that they're seeing and their experiences of watching ice break up.
I know there was a big flood in Dawson in 79. Have the water levels been higher since then, but now there's a dike?
No, the water levels haven't been higher. That is considered one of the kind of worst breakups, although there are historical records of maybe some worse breakups in the 40s and earlier. But that was quite a significant event, and it resulted in the raising of the dike, and we haven't seen water levels as high in Dawson since.
I know you mentioned things can change quickly at breakup season. Do you have an example of when water has risen very quickly or things have just happened very quickly?
Yeah, well, for example, I was looking back through historical records for that 79 flood in Dawson, and there was, you know, an anecdote of the water rising a meter in 3 to 4 minutes. So, you know, I've never seen that myself, but I mean, things can rise really quickly. Like, if certainly meters in several meters in a couple hours is not unheard of. So it's definitely an event that is happening way more quickly and dynamically than, for example, just flows increasing because of snow melt.
Yeah, and I was reading up on that flood this morning, and I think like buildings were floating away in Dawson, and people were literally like paddling down the street. And yeah, it was a very damaging flood, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I will say also in terms of kind of maybe also other interesting or shocking facts, in 1991, Old Crow had its flood of record, and the accounts say that 90% of the town was covered in over a meter of water. So that kind of gives you a sense of just like how expansive that flood was.
There's been also, this isn't in the Yukon, but Eagle, Alaska, downriver of Dawson, they had a bad incident in 2009. And I don't think it was a flood, but I think it was actually like the ice got pushed into their community and the ice took out like a part of the old village of town. So I mean, as a public, I think more of like, ooh, the flooding, but also like ice is very destructive.
Yeah, that's right. Ice is really destructive. And, you know, you after an ice jam, you can see blocks of ice, you know, meters above where you, you know, see the water level that's left behind. And so ice can be really destructive. It can be destructive to infrastructure, you know, bridges, any kind of shoreline infrastructure. It can be destructive to the ecosystem as well. You know, the riparian areas get really impacted by ice jamming and ice scours. So yeah, no, ice is definitely an element to consider as well.
What's the size of some of the blocks of ice that you've seen?
I mean, I've definitely stood beside blocks of ice that are bigger than me in terms of like even height and then, you know, quite a bit bigger. So yeah. And when, you know, when breakup is progressing, there can be some pretty big chunks moving their way down. It's just like a slurry of ice moving its way through and pushing as the water level gets up with those big blocks and little blocks getting pushed up on the shore. So it's a pretty impressive event to watch.
And some sounds probably associated with that too.
Yeah, I mean, we were replaying some videos in the office the other day. And I mean, really the best description is just like really loud radio static. It's just like this constant static of the ice just rushing past you. So, yeah.
How sort of like predictable based on the stats and like the numbers and the research and the imagery you have, how predictable is breakup? Like if with all the numbers come together, are you able to kind of keep a good eye on it? Or is there a sort of a large degree of not error, but just like variability?
I guess the first thing I'll say is like the timing is within a range, and we have really long records. You know, in Dawson, we have a record going back to 1896 to the gold rush. So we have a good idea roughly what the timing of breakup has been, how it's been changing over the last century, and what it has been in the last kind of decade. So on average in Dawson City, we see breakup in around early May. We have seen breakups as early as April 23rd in the last, you know, in 2016 and 19. So we, again, are seeing breakup earlier. But in general, kind of end of April, early May, we have breakup in Dawson, and typically about a week later, we have breakup in Old Crow. So we know those things. We also know the locations that are more prone to breaking up earlier. We kind of understand some of the progression of how breakup moves along these rivers. We know locations that might be more prone to ice jamming. But after that, there's just a lot of changes that are very weather dependent. It really matters how the ice froze up. It matters how thick it got. It matters how much melt it's seen before some of these flows start rising. And it also matters how much snow is on the ground. And in particular, in the week or two before breakup, it really matters how quickly it warms up. So if it's really cold and then just suddenly warms up, we're way more concerned than if it melts more gradually. So it is really challenging to predict breakup, and we don't actually produce, breakup forecasts for an exact date, but we do give a general idea of when breakup might be occurring, the signs that we're seeing out on the landscape, and what we might expect for concerns to communities. And that's what we communicate to our emergency response partners so that they have a better idea and can prepare accordingly.
So in terms of like some conditions that might be most not problematic, but could be potentially, would that be like high snowpack, really cold, and then sudden warming? That's sort of like what you don't want to happen.
You nailed it, Karen. You're going to come be a forecaster.
Did my research.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, it's a bigger snowpack is certainly of concern. And it's not like we're going to see all of that snowpack melting prior to breakup. But if we do just even have a large snowpack, and we have, most importantly, that really sudden warming, that can be a big problem. And that needs to be, of course, also combined with the ice thickness element. So if we have that with the thinner ice pack, it might not be as concerning as if we head into breakup knowing we have a really well above average ice cover.
Has climate change made this forecasting more complicated?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, like I mentioned, we have a really long record in Dawson, and we have a fairly long record in Old Crow, and we know that breakup is happening earlier. In Dawson, that's 8 days earlier over the period of record. So that's pretty significant. And when we have that earlier warming, there's just a whole bunch of different factors at play. So I think I've said this a lot of times, but it depends on how thick the ice is. It depends on what the weather's doing. So if we have, warmer winters, we might not see those really thick ice packs. But if we have really high flow in the fall that results in more dynamic freeze up, we might actually have more jumbled ice covers in some locations. So both of those factors might, be canceling each other out in any given year. We also know that if we have earlier warmer air temperatures, that could result in more melting of that and decaying of the ice. That could contribute to decreased intensity of breakup. But we also have more sporadic conditions where we might have really cold early Aprils, and then all of a sudden snap warm temperatures. So it's really hard to say exactly what climate change will mean for the frequency and the intensity of breakup and resulting ice jams. It is really kind of a year-to-year thing, but we do understand roughly the factors that play into it. And that forecasting is what allows us to kind of provide the best information we can in the moment.
There's a reason why you have a master's degree. There's a lot of factors.
That's right. Yeah. It's a pretty complicated process.
What do you like about your work?
I think it's super fascinating to be, watching these rivers. As you mentioned, I did my master's in ice breakup. There's nothing like watching a breakup event and watching an ice jam release. Scientifically, it's really interesting. Having watched ice jams release, it can be really exciting, but also it's useful work. I think it's really important work that myself and my team do to understand what's going on with breakup, to track those conditions, and to provide that sort of early information to the emergency response officials and communities so they can keep their communities safe. So yeah, it's challenging work. It's a lot of kind of moving parts that we're trying to keep track of. And as you mentioned, Karen, it can be stressful to provide good forecasts with sometimes very limited amounts of information to kind of make your best, put your best information forward so that folks can use that with conditions that are constantly evolving. The weather forecast might say one thing one day, and then that's shifting. We have a different system coming through. So yeah, it's definitely challenging, but it's also really rewarding.
What's the most memorable breakup you've seen?
I think I would have to say watching just ice jams along the Klondike in different areas a couple years ago. Actually, several times now, I've managed to watch ice jams just as they've released, just by pure chance, along the Klondike River Valley. And I mean, the breakups aren't as big there as along the Yukon River, and it's really fun to watch those big ice chunks rolling through town. But there's nothing like watching something that's still, and then all of a sudden seeing the first ice chunk move, and then all of a sudden you've got, you know, the ice jam moving, and you maybe drive downstream and watch it at different moments and watch kind of that pulse of ice coming through. So I feel like that's been really fun the last few years watching that happen on the Klondike.
I was wondering, when there is an ice jam, do we do anything about it? Is there like the old like put a stick of dynamite in there and try to blow it up? Is there anything like that that happens?
Yeah, I mean, mitigation for ice jams takes several forms. There is some infrastructure you can put in place sort of ahead of time to try to reduce the occurrence of ice jams. Once an ice jam is in place, there's a variety of sort of things to consider. And I think the really important one is just considering kind of the health and safety of anyone that might be kind of doing anything about the ice jam, any kind of operators, and also downstream communities. So, I mean, certainly in the past, I do understand that, you know, sticks of dynamite have been put into ice jams, but you really want to understand what is going to happen if you do that. You talked about kind of the powerful influence of ice. If you're kind of putting force into this, you've got ice moving, you also could be, you know, diffusing a situation in one location, but then pushing that ice downstream to flood in the next location. So that's certainly a consideration. So yeah, certainly, I mean, in terms of options, explosives have been used in the past, as well as I'm aware of amphibious excavators that are able to kind of break up ice jams. But again, not something that's very commonly done, certainly not done in the Yukon. But you really have to consider what the potential implications could be of trying to move an ice jam.
Yeah, it's just Alaska downriver. Just kidding. Okay, so for the upcoming breakup season, where should people go if they want to stay up to date on what's happening?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, flooding in the Yukon occurs primarily as a result of both river ice breakup and snowmelt peak flows. So one thing that we do is we track snow really closely in the late winter. And so, you know, our first snow bulletin is our first opportunity to communicate conditions around the snowpack, but also conditions that contribute to ice jamming. And so we have snow surveys that take place in March, April, and May. Our first snow bulletin will be out in mid-March. And so folks can find that when it's out on yukon.ca. And for breakup specifically, we don't actually provide public updates on river breakup unless there's a flood risk to a community. It is just one of the flooding factors, and we work really closely with communities to keep them up to date when we have concerns around flooding related to breakup or snowmelt. And when we do have concerns, we issue advisories. So closer to the breakup season, there could be high water advisories, flood watches, if an ice jam forms that we're concerned about that could have implications for flooding in the community, or flood warnings when, you know, flooding is imminent. So that's the way that we communicate with the public. But certainly to find out more information, our snow bulletin is a great first look at what's happening. And it's released, as I mentioned, in March, April, and May, and you sort of see the season progress.
And once you get to breakup season, no news is good news for folks.
That's right.
Wonderful. Well, thanks, Holly, for coming in and telling us all about breakup. Hopefully we have a smooth season this spring.
Yeah, certainly. Thanks a lot for having me, Karen.
That's it for this episode of Yukon North of Ordinary, the podcast. Please share this episode and leave us a review. It really helps. Subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our print magazine by going to northofordinary.com. While you're there, check out Yukon North of Ordinary merchandise. And for a full product line, visit the Bricks and Mortar Store in Whitehorse, located on the corner of 2nd Avenue and Steele Street, across from City Hall. There's a great selection of clothing, hats, stickers, glassware, and more. Do you have something to say about this episode? We'd love to hear from you. Find us on social media at North of Ordinary. You can also contact me, Karen McCall, with feedback or story ideas. editor@northofordinary.com is my email. Thanks to the whole team at North of Ordinary Media. Our podcast artwork is by art director Manu Kegenhoff. Our music is by Head Candy and tribeofnoise.com. Thanks for listening. We have another episode coming out soon. I hope you listen in.